Hit the circuit breaker. High anxiety in global markets over the coronavirus. We look at what's really going on in the economy, oil, stocks, and disease. Plus, what good is it to stop people from traveling?
Travel restriction can be important to buy time. So they can slow down the importation of cases. However, they are not enough alone.
Also today, south of the border, women are protesting, daring Mexico to imagine life without them. And a 17th century woman finally gets credit as the true artist behind a classic painting.
We claimed part of the sword in the painting, and there was her signature as well, which was just a wonderful moment.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Italy is about to close. Starting tomorrow, Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte says he is extending the ban on travel that he imposed on northern Italy to the entire country. He calls it the I Stay Home Decree for some nearly 60 million people. Here's Milan's deputy mayor, Pier Francesco Maran.
Many citizens think they wouldn't get the coronavirus, so they can do whatever they want.
He calls coronavirus an enemy you can't see. As Italy faces a spread of illness, it can learn from China's experience. Alessandro Vespignani is a researcher at Northeastern University who models the spread of infectious diseases. He's been studying how China's early travel restrictions in Wuhan affected the spread of the virus worldwide.
What we see from China is that travel restriction can be important to buy time. So they can slow down the importation of cases and then start later the epidemics in other places in the world. However, they are not enough alone. So we also need to curb the epidemic to have mitigation in the local community. So we need to lower the transmissibility of the disease.
So would the world look different now if those restrictions in China had not been in place?
Oh, yes. For sure, we would have epidemics, large epidemics in more countries and more places within the countries. We had 3 weeks or 4 weeks with less activity and no transmissions internationally, and that has allowed the community to prepare and to develop contingency plans for when the epidemic will start.
What does it mean for countries, though, that did not move as quickly as China, that did not buy the extra time for other countries that were not yet infected?
Other countries now are starting to do the same as China. Italy, has, for instance, has a very large epidemic at the moment and is going into a lockdown like China. I think several European countries might follow those mitigation interventions. In the United States, we have to be prepared to see activities rising internally as well, because we had importation of cases and we had some transmissions of the disease. So actually, what we are seeing now in Europe will probably happening in some part of North America and then more generally globally.
So are you saying the United States needs to take this much more seriously and follow what Europe is doing?
It will depend on how vast the number of chains of transmission that have generated cases in the U.S. And I think this will be more clear with further testing of cases and more capacity that the states are acquiring at the moment of identifying and detecting cases. It's obviously a possibility that in some places we will have to cope with some level of inconvenience, in a sense, in terms of some level of social distancing measures that helps to mitigate the epidemic, as we are seeing in some European countries.
Have you seen travel restrictions backfire, like an interruption in the flow of necessary medical equipment, things like that?
That's one of the risks, especially if you extend that too much, if you start to destroy the supply chain. And for certain countries that are especially the country that generally are the most poor countries in the world, that is a big problem. All the measures and containment measures that we put in place in containing or mitigating an epidemic have a cost, and you don't want to disrupt completely the social and the economic fabric of a country. That's another important point that should be factored in the decision-making process.
Alessandro, you're from Rome, but I know you've got family in northern Italy. How are they doing right now? Are they in lockdown? Have you spoken with them?
They are unfortunately in lockdown, and the situation is quite serious there, because the healthcare system is basically at capacity, and if the epidemic continues to grow, they will have to make really very tough decision, and like really who admitting to hospitals or not, depending on very, how to say, elements like, you know, people who have a life expectation that is longer. And so, you know, this is really something that is worrisome there. At the same time, they are pursuing very aggressive interventions, and I hope that in the next few days we will see a decline of the epidemic there. This has been successfully done not just in China, but also in South Korea, in Singapore, in Hong Kong. So I hope that will happen in Italy too.
Alessandro Vespignani, an expert on the spread of infectious disease at Northeastern University here in Boston. Thank you very much, Alessandro.
Thank you very much.
Authoritarian governments, it has to be said, have real advantages when it comes to confronting something like the coronavirus outbreak. Members of the public are expected to keep their mouths shut and follow instructions. But we found one young man in Shanghai who's taking issue with the Chinese government's approach. He's worried about getting in trouble with authorities, so he asks that we use the name Ren to refer to him. In translation, Ren means person or human being.
Since mid-February, when the situation came a little bit under control, they started to convince people that the outbreak has basically been a victory of the Chinese people and government. And right now, I think as the virus spread into the rest of the world and it is becoming a global pandemic, China is now calling the whole world to thank and learn from China and try to convince people that what went on in our country is totally acceptable and our measures have been very effective. And this has led some people around me, I've seen them laughing on other countries such as Japan, South Korea, or the US, basically saying the people there are not getting cautious enough for this issue.
Ren told us the Chinese government's response to the coronavirus was prompt, but it was terribly managed, he says. And he described the lockdown in Wuhan as sudden and aggressive.
Many patients who got the virus in the early stage, they were basically forced to stay at home because they couldn't get diagnosed or treated at the hospitals, which are just overcrowded. On the other hand, they were restricted from just traveling anywhere to any other cities where they might have a higher chance of finding space in the hospital and survive.
Ren says makeshift hospitals built quickly in Wuhan were also poorly managed, at least when they first opened. Patients were often admitted by force.
There was basically no one taking care of the patients. A lot of it just became a kind of violent enforcement. The police or like local authority, they would literally, if there's like a suspected patient, they would literally like seal the door or the entrance to the building. And also on the street, you can see a lot of videos of, you know, people just being violently attacked and then dragged to the hospital. Tens of thousands of medical staff and doctors, they were sent to Wuhan. They were not given enough protection. According to official reports, over 3,000 of them have been infected with the virus.
Ren says citizen journalists reporting on conditions in Wuhan have been detained. Their whereabouts are unknown, and the official news media are using a strategy that the Chinese call making a wedding out of a funeral.
It avoids mentioning any of the sorrow of this tragedy. Instead, choose to praise everything people have done and then refuse to take any account or responsibility for what went wrong in the first place.
Although he's critical of his government's response to the coronavirus in Wuhan, Ren says most people in China do not blame top government officials.
Even when they get angry, they would only stop at questioning the local officials in Wuhan and Hubei. However, they refuse to go one step further and realize that actually under this bureaucratic system in China, all the worst decisions were actually coming straight from Beijing. It was the central government, it was the highest leader who was making these mistakes.
That was a resident of Shanghai going by the name of Ren. He's decided to speak out against his government's approach to combating the coronavirus. The stock markets are spooked. European and Asian exchanges fell sharply today. Australia's stock market suffered its worst day in 12 years. Here in the U.S., the Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged 7% just minutes into trading this morning. That triggered an automatic circuit breaker, which halted trading for 15 minutes, a chance for traders to catch their breath. That hasn't happened in 12 years. The World's Jason Margolis covers the global economy for us. So, Jason, what is going on right now?
There's a lot of fear, there's panic, and there's problems with oil. So let's start with the first two. If you're a trader, you don't want to be the last one holding that stock. I was talking to a guy who manages mutual funds this weekend. And I said, well, you know, how was last week? How are things going? And he said, it's going really well. And I was surprised. What do you mean by that? And he said, all I have to do is I have to beat my competitors. Even if he loses 10 or 15%, as long as he outperforms the S&P 500 and other mutual funds, he looks pretty good. And that means if everybody else is selling, he kind of needs to sell too, or be very brave, go the opposite way from the pack, and hope his clients are very patient with some pretty big short-term losses. I also spoke with Michael Klein, who's an economist at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, and I asked him what's driving this market downturn. And he said there are concerns about global supply and demand, but there's also a lot of psychology at play here.
People are worried. So it's kind of like the first to the exits kind of thing.
Right. So a chain reaction of worry that leads to more worry. And of course, it's hard to manage psychology, especially when leaders are not conveying a sense of calm and reason. You also mentioned oil. What's going on with the oil sector?
During this coronavirus scare, the demand for oil has been falling. And Saudi Arabia decided this weekend to flood the market with more oil. It's a price war between Saudi Arabia and Russia. Justin Stewart with Seven Investment Management said the markets were unnerved by this unconventional decision.
It's moved from just being an economic issue into a political issue, which markets don't like. And the political issue is Russia and Saudi disagreeing as to how they should try and manage the price.
Right, the price of oil. We're going to be hearing more about the Saudi decision later in the show. And Jason, we should remind people of one key point here. The stock market is not the same thing as the economy, right? So how is the economy?
Yeah, you're exactly right. The U.S. economy is strong. Now, companies are losing money. If you run a hotel, if you are in the cruise ship industry, you're worried right now because people aren't going out as much. And oil companies are losing money too. There have been layoffs in Texas and other oil producing states. But the economic system is not fundamentally broken. I'm not trying to minimize what's going on right now, but this is a health epidemic that we're dealing with. It's hard to say how long this will go on for, but the underlying economic system is still functioning.
So you made a good point there. This is about health and disease and how it affects the economy. That seems different from other moments of panic that have put a check on the financial sector in the past.
You're totally right. So let's go back to 2008, and there was real fear. I'm not hearing that this time around. Economist Michael Klein said 12 years ago, there was a complete seizing up of the financial system. This time around, he says the internal workings of the economy aren't being destroyed.
It's more shock to international supply chains, slowdown in international demand, but it's not nearly as bad, I think, as what we saw in 2008. And I really hope I'm right about that.
Right. But Klein is a bit concerned that if we do tip into recession, interest rates are already so low and the budget deficit is so big that we won't have the monetary and fiscal tools to address that possible downturn.
So as far as that dictum, the economy is not the stock market and vice versa, let's talk about the stock market. What should people who are worried do?
Nothing. Now, that's not my advice. I've been reading a lot on this. I've been talking to a lot of people. And a lot of experts are weighing in. They say it's not a good idea to sell now. I mean, how would you feel if tomorrow the market comes roaring back? Nobody knows where the market is going. It may go up tomorrow. It may go down. In the long run, though, if you have the time and you don't need the cash anytime soon, it's a very, very safe bet that the markets will come back eventually. If you use history as your guide, stock prices will continue their long-term upward trend.
The World's Jason Margolis. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. In Mexico today, you'd basically be unable to see about half the adult population. Women are staying away from work, school, and public life. Yesterday, though, tens of thousands of Mexican women took to the streets. They're asking Mexicans to imagine what life would be like without them. The women are demanding an end to gender-motivated violence. Emily Green in Mexico City has been following their movement and has this report.
It's 8:30 in the morning on Monday in Mexico City, and this is normally peak commuting hour. The Metrobus is usually crammed with people, so full that it can be a struggle even to find a place to stand. But right now, there's just not that many women. I ask an elderly lady beside me, how does this normally compare to her commute?
50% menos. Yo siempre por lo regular me tengo que...
Bueno, she says it's about half the number of women as usual. The reason? There's a women's strike all across Mexico. The idea of women striking has existed for years in different parts of the world. But this year, in Mexico, it's taken on new life with the horrific back-to-back murders of a young woman and then a 7-year-old girl.
La idea de este lunes es que toda la gente, toda la sociedad, se pueda dar cuenta de lo molestas.
Veronica Berber is a human rights lawyer in Mexico City. She says the strike is meant to show just how exasperated women are by the daily aggressions and violence they suffer, and the lack of attention to this. Support for the strike has cut across class lines. Government and business officials stood behind it. The mayor of Mexico City told the city's 150,000 female workers they could stay home, although they wouldn't be paid. Walmart gave its female workers time off to join the strike. So did other big companies. I've now moved on to Sanborns. It's one of Mexico's biggest department stores. And while it's entirely men managing the cashiers, that's not normally the case. I asked one of the men, what does he think about the strike? He didn't want to use his voice, but he told me he doesn't support it. It sends a bad message for women not to show up to work. One business group said the strike would cost Mexico's economy more than $1 billion. And if today's strike is about showing what life in Mexico looks like without women, yesterday was the opposite. Tens of thousands of women took to the streets in Mexico City and across the country for International Women's Day. There were young women, like Mariana Hernandez. She's 23 and a college student. She says she wants to feel safe and for her parents not to worry if something bad will happen to her after class. And like a lot of young women, she was here with her mom, Raquel Rochalo, who says the growing feminist movement is creating change, even at home. I'm already seeing a change in my son and husband, she says. They're more aware, sensitive. This is the first time Rochalo has participated in a march on International Women's Day. I feel very proud to be here, she says, emotional. For the girls who have been raped and killed, we have to unite. In Mexico, violence against women has been bad for years, especially as drug cartels gain power in the country. So why is the issue becoming such a rallying cry now? Selma Maxinez is a lawyer in Mexico City and part of a feminist collective. She says violence against women and the impunity for the violence has been normalized in Mexico.
Ya nos estamos cuestionando más y estamos teniendo un hartazgo mucho más grande.
The difference now is that young women are questioning and rebelling against it, she says, and their outrage is unifying more women. Still, there's some discomfort with this latest stage of the women's movement here. Marta Lamas is one of the more well-known feminists in Mexico. She says it's an historic moment here, but the emphasis on violence makes her uncomfortable.
I mean, I'm a very old-fashioned feminist, and I'm a little bit disconcerted that the issue about work and working conditions has suddenly gone out of the picture, and all we talk about is about violence.
But for many women in Mexico, that is the issue most top of mind. Like for Fabiola Ramirez, an Uber driver in Mexico City. She recently separated from her husband after years of emotional abuse. She supports the strike.
Está haciendo que muchas mujeres que ni siquiera se conocen se unan en una sola voz para un fin en común que a todas nos beneficia.
She says the strike is bringing together women who didn't know each other before and creating a single voice against the violence they suffer. But Ramirez can't take the day off. She has to work to support her children.
Mi corazón y mi pensamiento está en poder.
But she says, my heart and thoughts are in supporting this movement. For The World, Emily Green, Mexico City.
More on the fight for female recognition coming up later this hour. A 17th century Italian painter is finally getting her due.
The male patriarchy of art history has dominated what we know of art.
That's slowly changing, though. One great painting long attributed to a male painter now has a woman's stamp on it. Two men claimed to be the rightful elected president of Afghanistan, and they both held competing inauguration ceremonies today. The World's Shirin Jafari explains.
Ashraf Ghani's inauguration ceremony started out like any other. A military band played the national anthem, and Ghani took the oath of office as Afghanistan's newly re-elected president. He told the audience that Afghanistan needs to rid itself of corruption and that he is the man who can achieve this. But his speech was interrupted. Rockets landed nearby. There was confusion. Some people ran to take shelter. But Ghani was undeterred. He proudly popped open his jacket and showed everyone that he was not wearing a bulletproof vest. No deaths were reported from the explosions. A short distance away, Ghani's opponent in the election, Abdullah Abdullah, held his own inauguration ceremony. Abdullah claims that he is the rightful president. He says the election was fraudulent, even though the Electoral Commission certified Ghani as the winner. The U.S. Special Envoy tried to mediate. He shuttled back and forth between the two rivals, hoping for some sort of compromise. But nothing. Meanwhile, American troops are preparing to withdraw from Afghanistan, part of an agreement signed between the United States and the Taliban. What happened today shows that the U.S. is leaving behind a country in chaos and that the nation faces a long, bumpy road to peace. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
You're listening to The World. Migrants are trying to get into Greece from Turkey. Greeks are furious that Europe doesn't have their back.
This border, she says, it's not just a Greek border. It's the far edge of the European Union itself.
And hostility at the Greek-Turkish border compounds the suffering of migrants. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. Thousands of migrants and refugees are trying to cross the Turkish border into Greece. European leaders want to avoid a repeat of what happened 5 years ago, when hundreds of thousands of people from the Middle East and beyond made their way into the European Union. Many traveled through Turkey. This time, though, EU officials say the Turkish government needs to do more. Many Greeks who live near the border say the same thing. The World's Lydia Emanolidou sent us this story from the village of Kastanyes.
In recent days, the border here between Greece and Turkey has been chaotic. On the Turkish side, hundreds of migrants are gathered at the border fence trying to cross. On this side, Greek army and police forces are here to stop them. Clashes have broken out between the two sides day and night. Tear gas, smoke bombs, rocks, water cannons fly back and forth over the fence. It's all happening right down the street from Fotini Gugulidou's house. On this bright morning, she's watering the plants out front. Gugulidou has lived in this village her whole life. She and her husband had a farm. They're now retired. She says this place has always been peaceful.
But she says things changed last month when Turkey stopped preventing migrants from trying to cross the border. Greece responded by refusing to accept asylum applications, at least temporarily. The UN says that might violate international refugee law. Greece also deployed hundreds of security forces to the border, but some migrants have managed to make it through. And authorities here in Castanes shut the border. No one's allowed to cross. All of this is affecting real people in real ways on both sides of the border. Stelios Panayos runs a cafe about two blocks from the border crossing. Today the place is mostly empty, which is not normal. Panayos tells me it's usually full with locals and with Turks who come over to Castanes just for the day. They drive or even just walk. It's that close. And Greeks would do the same thing when the border crossing was open. It's like we were the same country, as if there were no border, Panayos tells me. He says he misses his Turkish neighbors and friends, but he is livid at their government, especially President Erdogan. Panayos says Turkey is orchestrating this whole situation for political gain. He says Erdogan is trying to blackmail the European Union to get more support in Syria and for the nearly 4 million migrants and refugees currently in Turkey.
Fake news. Propaganda.
Fake news, propaganda. That's what he calls criticism from Turkey about the way Greece is handling the situation. People here tell me, look at the economy. Greece is in no position to help large numbers of migrants. Later on in the village, I run into Fotini Gugulidou. She's meeting up with friends after church for coffee. This really is a small village, about 800 people, the kind of place where everyone pretty much knows everyone. Gugulidou and her friends say they feel like the EU has abandoned Greece. Katerina Sourgoutzidou says they left us helpless. She wants the EU to do more because this border, she says, it's not just a Greek border. It's the far edge of the European Union itself. The EU is giving Greece about $780 million in aid. It's also deployed European border guards. But Sourgoutzidou says that's not enough. She says everyone needs to just stop kissing up to Erdogan. And other European countries, she says, need to take more of these migrants in and stop criticizing Greece for defending its border. She says Hungary closed its borders, Austria closed its borders, and no one said a word. Meanwhile, some locals here are starting to take matters into their own hands. One younger guy from a nearby village tells me they formed a vigilante group and they're armed. They scope the area around the border and hunt down migrants who manage to make it through. He agrees to speak with me only if I don't use his name because what he's doing is illegal. We're not racists, he tells me. We used to help the refugees coming through the border. But what's happening now, he says, is an invasion. So I ask, what do you do with the migrants when you find them? We offer them hospitality, he says, and then adds, I won't tell you anything else. Meanwhile, other locals, like Stelios Panayos, the coffee shop owner, says everything's under control for now. Panayos and a couple hundred other men in the village are also members of the Greek National Guard. They're trained civilians with weapons issued by the government and are ready to mobilize if they're called on to help protect the border. Panayos says they're waiting for orders from the police and the army. We're not playing tough. This is a serious situation and we need to be calm. This isn't Texas, he told me. For the world, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou, Castanes, Greece.
The new coronavirus has now been detected in about half of all the countries on Earth. North Korea officially claims zero infections, even though the country is sandwiched between China, where the outbreak began, and South Korea, which has the most cases outside of China. It should be said that the North Korean regime is isolated and notoriously secretive. Grace Moon is a reporter in Seoul in South Korea, where she's been speaking with defectors from North Korea.
So North Korea hasn't reported any coronavirus cases yet, but the virus is predicted to have started spreading around the end of December last year, which is also around the same time UN sanctions demanded that China repatriate all North Korean workers by. So it was during this period when North Korean laborers were moving between China and the DPRK that the virus is said to have been contracted and started to spread.
And of course, DPRK is the official name of North Korea, Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Hard to say whether there are any cases of COVID-19 in North Korea right now. So if it hits, what are the conditions of hospitals in North Korea and how serious would it be if the virus does spread there or has already started to?
From what I've learned, hospitals in North Korea are vastly unprepared. I spoke to someone who has deep connections in North Korea to figure out what's going on inside the country. His name is Kim Seung-chul, and he's a defector himself who left in 1993. Now he's the president of North Korea Reform Radio, which broadcasts into North Korea from over the border. I asked Mr. Kim to describe what would happen if everyday citizens in North Korea got sick and needed to be treated.
주민들이 아파서 오게 되면 치료를 해주는 그 치료약과 치료 설비를
According to Mr. Kim, many are at risk of dying. Without money, people can't receive any kind of treatment. But even if you have the money, you still may not be able to be treated because the hospitals are that unequipped and lack fundamental supplies. What a lot of people end up doing is buying their own medical appliances at the black market, then bringing those items to the doctor to receive consultations. Sick people are actually not even permitted to visit hospitals right now because the government is afraid they may spread the virus. They have to first report their sickness and then have to wait to be granted entry.
And again, this is what defectors from the north who are now in the south have told you. What about medical attention for the political elite of North Korea compared with how normal citizens will fare if there is a major outbreak?
So the coronavirus, like all previous outbreaks, disproportionately affects basically everyone outside of North Korea's minuscule elite circle. Here's what Mr. Kim said about how resources in North Korea are distributed. Essentially, any aid sent to North Korea will most likely be divided only among the most powerful elites, like military officers, the State Security Department, or intellectuals, probably never even reaching ordinary citizens. People are facing what Mr. Kim said could easily become a period reminiscent of the famine that struck in the late 90s. Maybe even worse because of the border lockdown that makes defecting almost impossible.
So from the North Korean defectors you've spoken with in South Korea, what is their biggest concern about coronavirus right now?
From the conversations that I've had with defectors, they do not see coronavirus as some accident. They view it actually as a systemic issue of the drastic wealth and power gap that exists in the country. And they are very worried and actually are reminded of the great famine that struck in the 90s and worried about their family members and the situation even being worse.
Grace Moon is a reporter based in Seoul. She's been speaking with us about concerns among North Korean defectors and the coronavirus back in North Korea. Thank you very much, Grace.
Thank you.
Back to our top story today, the coronavirus and what it's doing to the economy worldwide. As you heard earlier, global markets are plummeting. Now Saudi Arabia and Russia have thrown an additional wrench into the works.
The big driver in Monday's sell-off, a huge crash on the crude oil markets.
Today, the oil price plunged 30%.
Experts now forecast a further plunge down to $30 or worse in the coming days.
Ellen Wald has been following the slide in oil prices closely. She's the author of Saudi Inc., The Arabian Kingdom's Pursuit of Profit and Power. Ellen, what happened? Why did prices fall so quickly?
Last week, Saudi Arabia and OPEC, which is the organization of petroleum exporting countries, decided that it was really important to respond to falling demand for oil from the coronavirus. And so they asked for a cut in oil production. And essentially, Russia said, no, we're not interested. The whole meeting fell apart and the two parties basically walked out on each other. And at that point, it became clear that we were going to see a price war. Saudi Arabia cut its prices on the oil that it sells to Asia and the United States almost immediately and said it was going to increase production. And then Russia came back and said today it's going to increase its own production. And news of that really sent oil futures into a tailspin on Sunday night, dropping 30%.
I mean, why would they do this? Aren't they just shooting themselves in the foot by lowering prices?
When it comes to who can outproduce one another, Saudi Arabia definitely has the advantage. But the big question now is who's going to buy all that oil? Because of this coronavirus and because of the effect on demand that it's having, are there going to be enough buyers out there? We know that China has ordered less oil, about 30% reduction in its oil imports. Now, that will recover, but we don't know when that recovery is going to take place.
Ellen, what was Russia's angle here? Are they still a top oil producer in the globe? And wouldn't they have originally benefited from raising prices?
Well, right now, Russia is actually the second largest oil producer on the planet after the United States. So they are a top oil producer. Oil is a big part of their budget. But from their perspective, they don't see any benefit in protecting the group, whereas Saudi Arabia and OPEC have an objective to protect the group of OPEC. Russia doesn't care. It's going to do what it wants, and it did not see a benefit in cutting production to maybe push oil prices up a little bit.
Does Russia want higher prices? I mean, is that kind of the end goal here, just keep on pushing it up and up?
Well, like I said, Russia doesn't necessarily need higher prices. What these countries want is money. They want revenue, and revenue can be achieved either by selling less oil for more money or selling more oil for less money. Of course, the big question is if there's no demand, if there are no customers for this oil, then we may see a low price action for quite some time.
We have, of course, seen stock markets all over the world react very nervously to coronavirus. So what does this oil pricing war mean for a global economy already dipping because of uncertainty around coronavirus?
It's definitely participating and contributing to fears and sell-off that we're seeing. If you just look at some of the stock prices for the oil companies in the U.S., they have dropped precipitously. I mean, we're seeing some companies losing almost 50% of their value in basically 2 days. I do think that it will recover, but we're in a place where there's a lot of hysteria, and this is definitely feeding the market hysteria.
On top of all of that, there's been another shakeup in the Saudi royal family. Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, has prompted the arrest of three members of the royal family, including Mohammed bin Nayef. What's going on?
Well, that's a big question, is what exactly is going on. And it would certainly seem that it shows on the part of the royal family that there's a lot of fear. Now, authoritarians tend to detain people all the time. But the larger scheme of all of this shows that it's more than just a regular detention of political rivals by an authoritarian power. The crown prince and the king are fearful and willing to arrest some of the king's closest family. I mean, this wasn't just people in the royal family. This was the king's full brother and nephew. So whether or not there was really any kind of plot, this is a warning.
Ellen Wall, the author of Saudi Inc., thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
On Wednesday, we will mark the 9-year anniversary of the Fukushima disaster, an earthquake and tsunami in northeast Japan that killed more than 18,000 people and triggered the meltdown at the nuclear power plant in Fukushima. Nearly a decade on, some towns nearby are only just starting the rebuilding process. In the actual evacuation zone, there's a tour group that will show you around. Tour founder Karen Tyra takes small groups into the irradiated area. She says a lot of visitors expect some kind of post-apocalyptic adventure.
Radiation sounds very scary, so some people might be really excited to visit the area with radiation.
As eerie as that might sound, Tyra hopes a tour can humanize the story of Fukushima and its victims.
You rather have to know or feel the sadness of this disaster, or how people have been suffering from this disaster.
The tour grants rare access into the exclusion zone. Visitors see abandoned homes, overgrown roads, and nature taking over previously bustling towns. Tyra says one of the most moving stops on the tour is a fish processing plant that was destroyed by the tsunami's 40-foot waves.
From that factory, 9 people died. So then you would know how scary the tsunami was.
The tour also goes to towns near the Fukushima plant that are slowly resettling. Tyra introduces visitors to a 94-year-old man named Sei Mei, who came back after being away for years.
He's quite lively and he likes joking, so quite fun to hear his story. While you can feel his grief or what he lost through this evacuation.
Visitors can see the progress that's been made in 9 years. Fields of solar panels, storage areas for radioactive waste. But Tyra says they're a long way from full recovery.
We need another decade, you know, another 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. It would take a long way, but we will never give up.
Tyra says she hopes visitors can connect what happened in Fukushima to the energy they use every day.
So I think if people use electricity, this disaster is not none of your business. I think all the people in this world can learn something from this disaster. So that's why we want to encourage people to visit here.
The tours are on pause right now because of worries over the coronavirus, but Tyra says she hopes they will start up again soon. Here's a story from the art world about hidden treasure. Recently, a painting of David and Goliath fell into the hands of art conservator Simon Gillespie in London, a painting that had long been attributed to a male artist. But while cleaning it, Gillespie discovered something incredible. David and Goliath was actually the work of Artemisia Gentileschi, the most celebrated female artist of the 17th century.
When it arrived, I thought, hello, yes, this is exactly why somebody's walked past it. Somebody's overpainted this picture. Just looked like, you know, a Hollywood version of what you might hang in the back of a romantic scene somewhere. And it was dirty, dull. You couldn't see into it. You couldn't see any of the quality. But you could see that there was a quality behind the decision to make it. I urged the owner to let us do some cleaning tests, and we did, and we found that underneath it was some really nice quality brush strokes and quality of paint. The cream on the cake came when we cleaned part of the sword in the painting, and there was her signature as well, which was just a wonderful moment.
Yeah, must be a brilliant moment. You've said you consider this a genius painting. Why is that?
Yes, two things about that. One is you can see how she has applied paint in order to make it a three-dimensional and realistic object. Bearing in mind, this is quite a modern way of painting at this stage and was a little bit frowned on. But then very soon, very quickly, after Caravaggio had been around within the decade, you know, it became the fashionable object, the fashionable thing. Her way of depicting a person is always with an enormous amount of personality. She learned to paint from her father, who was the most elegant painter with color and composition, but his figures didn't have any personality at all. They looked like marble carvings. This woman always put in a huge amount of personality. Sometimes that personality would have come from her own life and what had happened in her life as well.
So as to her story, who was Artemisia Gentileschi, and what do you think it was like to be a woman in the 1600s as a painter?
It must have been pretty exciting, especially her, as we know her. She's a pretty feisty person, stands up on her own 2 feet. She's a bit like Damien Hirst or one of these other punchy artists of the moment, Andy Warhol. Her story has been taken over by the mishap that happened in her early teens or late, more mid-teens, when she was raped by a friend of the family and an assistant to her father. And that has been her main calling card to history, which is wrong, because she's a really top quality, top draw painter. That should be her calling card.
Although, now that you've made that point, we should also clarify that she aggressively pursued that crime in court, right?
Oh, very much so, yeah.
In the 1600s, that's extraordinary.
And she was put through horrible things. She was actually tortured to see whether she was telling the truth. Mm. She had thumbscrews put on her. So, yes, she stood up for herself. He was found guilty. But he never spent time in jail for it, which was wrong, of course.
Yes, so this painter, she's undergoing her own kind of renaissance right now. Why do you think that is? Is it obviously about the times we're living in?
The male patriarchy of art history has dominated what we know of art. All of the directors of museums, all the main collectors were men. They demanded what the heroic sort of pictures that they wanted. And the museum, since certainly in England, only had 3% in the year 2000, had 3% women artists in their collections. Since then, they've had positive discrimination to get more in, and they're up to 20, I think over 20% now. So that's quite a good rebalancing. But it's the subject matter which would have changed if we'd have had more women artists in at the beginning. And that, thank goodness, has now been corrected.
Simon Gillespie, an art conservator in London, speaking with us about the painting David and Goliath by Artemisia Gentileschi. Thank you, Simon. All the best.
All right. Great pleasure. Thanks.
And the painting was of David and Goliath. There is some poetic justice there, Signora Gentileschi. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.